make a start. So at the break, Mariette asked me to kind of chair this part, and I was frankly too scared to say no to her, so I'm taking care of this principal disclosure element. Now, it's agenda paper three. Catherine's going to talk us through it. There are kind of three sections with this paper. I think, Catherine, you said you're going to do section one, and then we'll discuss, and then we'll do the sections two and three separately.
Yes.
Over to you.
Thank you. Okay, good morning, everybody. So before I summarise the purpose of today's meeting and what we'd like to discuss, I thought it was worth just taking a minute to summarise where we are within the context of the project. So on slide two, you can see something of a timeline, and it's about a year now since we published the Principles of Disclosure discussion paper, after which we spent a good 7 months getting as much feedback as we possibly could from comment letters and outreach, and including from yourselves last October. We then spent a few months getting that feedback into a form that is summarised for the board, and we spoke to them about that feedback in detail at their meeting in February, which now leaves us in a position of having the March board meeting coming up in a couple of weeks. And for this project, that is going to be quite a significant meeting, because the board will be making decisions about project direction and what the next steps are going to be. So like I said, there will be big decisions, and that is largely because, as well as receiving a lot of feedback about the content of the discussion paper, we also received a lot of feedback saying that people wanted the board to really have a think about project direction, what's most important, and potentially narrow the scope to the things the board can do that can most help to improve the effectiveness of disclosure. So potentially some big decisions to come in March about what we'll be doing going forward. So what we've done today is pull out the areas of feedback where we would most like to get your input now in advance of the decision making in March. So there are three areas that we'd like to talk to you about today. The first one for us at this point is the biggest priority in terms of discussion. So if we do end up spending a bit of time on that, we would be fine with that. We're very keen to hear your views. So starting from slide five, we've got the first topic that we'd like to talk about, which I have broadly titled Addressing the Disclosure Problem. And what we are really talking about here is the fact that we had a consistent message from all of our stakeholders that agree there is a disclosure problem, they support the project, and they do think there are things the board can do that will help to make disclosure more effective going forward. However, we did get some mixed views and different perspectives on the underlying reasons for the problems that are seen today and the best things the board could do to make a difference. So what we wanted to do was summarise one of the perspectives that we heard and ask for your feedback on that perspective, because it is a little different from the high-level message we've heard mostly from users of financial statements, that the biggest concern is about a lack of relevant information. The perspective that I'm about to describe puts a slightly different focus on what people want to do. So on slide six, we've got a summary of the view that is held by a good number of preparers. And essentially the perspective they take is that the base reason for the problems with disclosures today is that IFRS standards contain a high volume of requirements, and those requirements tend to be quite prescriptive. And so companies therefore feel that they are forced into something of a large compliance exercise that is so big that they then don't think they have sufficient time to apply judgment in deciding what is best to disclose and how to best communicate information. So the advice we've received from some of our stakeholders is that they think the best thing the board could do would be to go and re-review the existing disclosure requirements in our standards. A lot of people refer to this as a standards level review, and whilst people have different objectives for what the board might achieve if they did that exercise, some think that an objective should be to find requirements that are considered to be unnecessary and look to reduce the level of prescriptive requirement today. Now, the reason we feel it's quite critical to talk about this in advance of March is because we didn't ask a particular question on standards level review in the discussion paper. So given that we've had a lot of feedback on that topic anyway, we wanted to give the opportunity to hear any feedback you have particularly on this so we can include it within what we talk to the board about in March. So on slide 7, we have got the specific questions we wanted to ask, which are firstly, whether you have any general views on the perspective that is described on slide 6, and whether you would agree with the idea that reducing the amount of prescriptive requirements would overall lead to improved application of judgment and improved disclosure. The second question relates to the fact that if the board did go down this route, what may well happen could be I could come to you in 4 months' time and ask you, you know, are there any requirements that you'd be happy to perhaps see the back of, or any requirements that you think are excessive? So to just get an idea there of whether you think anything does fall into that category today. And thirdly, a general question about whether you would support the board doing a review of disclosure requirements in standards today, and if they did do that, what you would see as the primary objectives of such an exercise. So with that, I will hand over for discussion.
Great. Thanks, Catherine. So maybe the starting point before we kind of address the questions are on slide 7. Does anyone have questions that they'd like to address to Catherine in terms of clarification or observations?
Yeah. Were the preparers were they specific at all in what areas they were seeking more, or they were seeking simplification?
I'd say that
a pretty general comment. It's like, do better.
Yeah, I'd say there are two schools of thought. There is one group that would just like requirements to be less prescriptive. Instead of telling companies you shall disclose absolutely everything, leave it a bit more open to judgment so they don't feel that it's it's easier for them to make a call about materiality than feeling that they have to comply with everything. The other camp is, of course, those people who identify specific disclosures within standards and consider them to be excessive. So people have raised many different specific examples of that. But, for example, some might talk about, say, some of the disclosures around financial instruments or share-based payments or pensions. Like there's different standards where people have said, we think not all of these disclosures are necessarily the most useful thing, and could they be reduced?
Catherine, I had one question, and you can dismiss it as irrelevant if you think that is the case, because it may be. But the point that you raise is a good one, and I've heard it before. And then my mind always goes back to IAS 1, which says, you know, you make disclosures where material. If they're not material, don't make them. Hmm. Do preparers just need a reminder of that? Say, guys.
That is an excellent question, and one that the board will definitely have on the table when they have this discussion. So those requirements in IAS 1 were in that particular paragraph that says exactly what you've described. Was introduced back in 2014, and it became effective at the beginning of 2016. So it has been there for a while. We received all of this feedback throughout 2017. And so on the one hand, you can go, that requirement is there in black and white, but we've had such a wealth of messaging around this issue that we've described, that I think we've got to consider the possibility that although that is there, it's not working today. And if the board can do something that would help, then...
Should we open up to comments, questions, starting with... Paul.
Thank you. I think Osman's point is exactly the one. That, you know, the overarching requirement is to produce reporting of what is material and no more than that. And if companies are not willing to rise to that challenge, it's their fault, fundamentally. So this question, this challenge that they're raising, you know, it's rubbish. I will use that term rather than a more technical term that I might use. You know, they need to exercise judgment and disclose what matters. It's as simple as that. And that would actually cut through all of this and move us on.
Could I, ask a question just to clarify that I understand what you're saying? So I think what you're saying is you wouldn't support the board revisiting disclosure requirements as they are today. Given the discussions we had in October and in the past about the fact that, you know, the disclosure problem exists and preparers are saying, in their view, they could apply more judgment if we went down this route, you on that basis, you wouldn't support the board.
This is not a standards problem. This is an attitude and approach problem. And, you know, what needs to change is a mindset around applying judgment and looking to communicate rather than to comply. And you know, compliance is not, it's not a one-way street. It's a decision that companies currently are making, and that's a mistake.
Okay, so we've got Jeff, then Goro, then Martijn.
It's a cost of stewardship. It's a cost of stewardship. I mean, they're taking risk of other people's cash. And I think as well, if you prescriptively reduce the amount of disclosure, you limit choice from an analyst's perspective. And that's what I kind of crave when I open up a set of accounts, is to see various things disclosed in different ways. And then I make a choice on how I interpret that. It gets back to Glenn's point on the market interprets the reactions of what the company's decisions are. So it goes back to IS1, it's materiality and it's a cost. If you want to be listed and you want to access capital markets and take other people's money and take risk with it, there's an element there. You have to make a decision on the disclosure that you provide.
All right.
Yeah. I believe that every disclosure requirement are supposed to be, first of all, relevant. And as other people suggested, that this is a problem of the application of the materiality. And if materiality is, the concept of materiality is applied properly, I believe that most of the problems should be solved. But the problem is that the materiality is not applied properly. And probably this is, I'm afraid that this might not be the problem of accounting standards, but rather that, as Paul said, that it's a kind of compliance issue. It's the issue of the compliance exercise. If so, I believe that it might be very difficult for the IASB by itself to solve this problem. And I believe that the IASB need to collaborate with the regulators. You know, that most of the, you know, this, you know, overwhelming material, overwhelming disclosures are coming from the, you know, requirement of each national regulators' disclosure requirements. Therefore, I believe that it should be very difficult for IASB to pursue to solve this problem by itself. Of course, you know that the IASB have to be mindful that every disclosure requirement of each individual standards to be working as intended. Thank you.
So just to put in, I just wanted to share this. We had an investor the latter part of last year talking about IFRS 15. IFRS 15 had turned accounting into a compliance exercise rather than a business exercise. And they were berating the disclosures to do with revenue. And most businesses, I believe revenue is material, yeah? It's a reminder in that sense. I think that materiality thing sometimes, it just gets lost.
Better be.
Yeah. Yeah, it's usually material.
That's Martijn.
I fully agree with Paul's comments. It looks like if you look at the proposal to review all disclosure requirements, that the ISB needs to provide evidence of the relevance again, because the evidence once was already provided, because else the standard wouldn't be in place. Of course, I would be open if there's clear evidence that a disclosure requirement is just is never going to produce relevant information or is hardly likely. I mean, I would be open to that, but let then the preparer come up with the evidence of the irrelevance of the for many sectors.
However,
maybe once they do that, they can use the IS-1 requirement to say it's not material.
Sorry, I do think there's a behavioral dimension to this, and somehow there's a, this fight between the auditors, the regulator, the company, and not even the investor in this particular case, that makes it difficult for the preparer to cut out disclosure requirements. So I do think there would be merit in a gesture from the ISB on a principle-based gesture to reiterate the relevance criteria, and that with that gesture somehow will shift the discussions between the auditor and the company in favor of not including irrelevant information. And in and so I do think there is merit for the ISB in acting on this with a focus on relevance. And
but you're saying the gesture at the top level, not at the standards level.
Yeah. Just to make sure that the behavioral dimension is addressed. We every now and then when there's a gender consultation, we send out a 20-page letter with ideas for very relevant additional disclosures. So I would always, of course, stay open as the ISB for new relevant disclosures. And there are so many grounds to tackle still. There's a lot to do. And that is additional work. Yes. We're not finished, yes. IFRS is not final. So we hope that the ISB especially stays receptive for additional relevant disclosures. Bank covenants, on dilution, on pro forma information. I mean, we can go on.
Okay.
Sorry, is it okay if I ask a question? I'm playing devil's advocate on purpose now because it's really helpful to us, given that we've had a lot of people give us a suggestion of something we could do to understand, you know, alternative perspectives on exactly what we should do. So given that back in 2014 we did issue an amendment that quite literally said, you know, apply materiality. If it's not material, don't disclose things. And 3 years later, we're still getting this feedback that constituents think that the board doing something at a standards level would still make things better. Do you have an idea in mind of what you would advise the board to do in terms of making a gesture that might help start the ball rolling with improvement?
Of course, I have an open indication, an open request for concrete, open request for concrete evidence that some disclosures are irrelevant. I mean, and make sure you get a very concrete, specific indications of these are. We cannot get rid of them, based on IS-1. And we still have to produce it, and it's not relevant. And then you can come back to us, and probably in most cases we will be able to identify the relevance, but maybe in some cases we won't. And I mean the much highlighted practice of providing irrelevant descriptions of accounting policies is so. I mean that. Every company has been doing that, and I can imagine that they complain. Why are we disclosing 12 pages of irrelevant information? Well, it's not that the information they could. There's a role for themselves in making that information more relevant, company specific. I think there is also like if it's post so general, I would. Sometimes also consider that the easiest way to reduce our reporting cycle is just if the ISB could slash 30% of all requirements, and that would help anyway. I mean, that's not in the interest of the public that is investing in those companies. clearly.
Glenn?
I actually have some sympathy with the preparers on this point for two reasons. One is, you know, we've gone through this discussion on IFRS 17. The preparers are telling us all that they think that the level of granularity for the portfolio that we're asking them to disclose is, in many cases, immaterial. I totally disagree that it's immaterial. If they were simply given carte blanche to say that they're not going to publish it on materiality grounds, I think I, as investor, would have lost something. So I don't want materiality to be only in the hands of the preparers. I don't want them to be the only parties who decide this. Because, you know, here's a very live example where you're being told that this is an immaterial requirement that you have put into a standard, and there are other people like me saying, no, it's not immaterial. Okay, and that brings you to the second point, which is that materiality is not just what the company thinks it is. And that's why they have to be careful about this, because the auditors, the legal advisors, are standing there saying, well, it might be material, might not be material in this context, but it is material in that context, or that context, or that context. And sometimes some politically important numbers like pay and things like that, gender, you know, the gender gaps and all that kind of stuff, these may be immaterial, but they are very immaterial in the context of the financials, but they're very material in the context of other debates that are taking place. So to some extent, if you were prepared of an account, of a set of accounts, you're going to be constrained by all these other factors, such that your line of defense is always going to be, the standard says, publish it, I publish it. So I think there is, and that's the defense against the, you know, the you didn't tell me something important. Well, I told you what the standard set, you know, what the independent standard set has told me I had to do, and I've discharged my requirements. So, you know, there's an argument here, you take it up with them. That's kind of the defense. Then the trouble comes, as the preparers have said, if that is onerous, it becomes a problem. So I think it's not just a question of attitude. It's not just a question of material of what the companies think materiality is. I think we need to be careful and define, you know, in certain contexts, we're going to specify that regardless of materiality, we want to see that information, or at least regardless of what the companies think is immaterial, we want to see that information. This is the granularity in the insurance contract. We want to see that, right? That's, you know, they may think it's immaterial, we think it's material, we want to see it. It may be the same thing with portfolios of bank, you know, in IFRS 9, the loss write-offs, where they have to do it by category, etc. We want to know how they categorize that stuff, we want to see that stuff. It may be that when you're doing pay and you're worrying about broader social issues, we want to see that. Maybe on tax, we want to know who's paid their tax in which jurisdiction, right? So that's also become, these are not, these, you know, they may say this is material. I don't pay any tax in the jurisdiction. I'm not paying, declaring it. Well, that's really material, right? So we want to see that. So I've got some sympathy with the preparers on this. I think Martin's point is also a very good one, which is that there needs to be some gesture that says the reason we're asking for this is because these are the, and I think that's a useful exercise for us. I mean, I may be unpopular. I mean, the last session we had, I think that's immaterial, personally. I think we had the whole discussion of MPMs, which to me left me completely indifferent. It was immaterial. We spent a lot of time discussing it, and I know I'm in a minority, so I'm not criticizing that. But if the preparers are forced to do something like that, I'm going to be one of the people saying, waste of time, right? There are bigger issues to consider. So I think there is a kind of, in the end, we can't just say it's down to material. That's my point. It is actually a question of saying, why do we want this? Why do we want this? Why do we want this? And I think the preparers are probably right on that. We have to justify it.
So would that suggest that we should be more thoughtful when we're actually setting standards in terms of explaining the disclosure and why that is required?
Yes, I think the standards as we have them right now are very good. And you know, if you read the back papers, etc., there's a very good explanation for why all the disclosures are there, etc. And I've got no criticism with anything that's published. I make a different point, which is there's a kind of set of priorities about which are the big, less is more in this field, isn't it? Because the market's going to debate a whole lot of financial issues that the standard setters don't have to get involved in. The market's going to do what it's going to do. It's never going to stop doing that. So the standard setters have to step in only when there is a consensus and a few parties are out of consensus, and it's to bring those few parties into consensus. You're never going to, when it's all 50-50 or there's a plurality and there's no kind of consensus, stepping into that debate is just going to get your feet blown off, basically. There's no point in that. So when most people are doing one thing and a few companies are not towing the line, you can bring them into line with a standard, right? And move on that basis. And each time, I think there's a case, just to go back to Nick's point, I think there's a case for saying a review of what we have and saying, why do we have it? Justify it. Why do we have it? And is it more important than something else that we have? And then we have a set of priorities about what is really, really, really important. If a company decides to take the income statement away, I mean, that would be really, obvious, right? But if a company takes away a gender pay disclosure, which is going to be required, right? Some people might think that's unimportant. Some people might think that's really, really important. We're going to say, as a stat, that is actually, regardless of what you think, other people think that's important. So we're going to have that.
Thanks, Glenn. My turn. So I think, Glenn, just touching on what you said, I think it was very interesting about the concept of materiality, because I think I have a different understanding of what materiality is. I don't think it's a purely company decision. Companies have to say, if I disclose this, will it change investors' view? Will it influence investors' view? If so, then it's material. So even a zero number can be material, as you pointed out, very good in tax. So I think, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I think it's more on touching on the proper application of materiality. Which
but we have a live debate on IFRS 17 right now.
Yeah.
Okay. A large number of companies are saying to the standard setters here, this information they're asking for is immaterial.
Investors are saying it's material.
For
me, from that perspective, it's material because they have to take the investor view. When they're reporting, they have to take the investor view.
They won't, because if you give them material, they will do it. If the standard says publish it, they will publish it. If you give them the judgment on materiality, some will and some won't.
So this takes me actually a little bit into the points I was going to make. I think they do have the judgment on materiality, but they have to take into account who they're reporting to, which is the stakeholders, the shareholders. And if it's material for them, then they have to make a disclosure. I wanted to touch on a couple of things that address kind of the questions one, probably. So I've said this before. I think this slide that you have on slide 6 about the preparer views about being too prescriptive and then this compliance environment, I think that's not... In some sense, it's not the ISB's problem, it's a securities regulator's problem. We have certain securities regulators in some jurisdictions that will actually tick through every disclosure requirement regardless of materiality, and that needs to change. I think the role of the ISB there is to protect your brand and say that's not the right approach, and don't be afraid to say that. I think the other thing that I wanted to kind of touch on is I talked about IS1 and saying that if something's not material, then don't disclose it. The other aspect, the other side of the coin is, once you've made all the disclosure requirements that you think are relevant, take a step back and say, I don't care if there's no disclosure requirements on the standard, there's something that's missing that would be important for investors to know, you need to make that disclosure. So I'm touching on here is, yes, maybe there is some irrelevant information in financial reports. I don't think anyone would dispute that, but I'm more worried about what's missing. And so, as you remind preparers of the IS1 requirements, if that's the approach that you decide to take, about not having to disclose stuff that's not material, even though it might be kind of required in a specific standard. The other side of the coin is even more important, I think, is what's missing, what do you need to disclose that is not specifically required by a particular standard, but in your context is important to disclose. That's the bigger problem that I think the ISB should be addressing. Preparers taking a step back and seeing what's missing rather than thinking about what's irrelevant. So in terms of the second question, are there particular areas where you think disclosure requirements are excessive? For me, that has to be no, because of the highest one requirement to say, take a step back and think about what's material for you. And do you think the board should review disclosure requirements in individual standards? I think there's an argument for that, potentially. Would it be fair for me to say, I think in some cases, perhaps more in the past than more recently, that where a decision couldn't be reached that satisfied everyone as to the classification measurement, then the fallback was, well, do it this way, but then disclose it the other way as well. Maybe there's some need for review of that not being so important now. But, that's kind of an over time thing as you do your post-implementation reviews or refreshments. I don't think it's an urgent requirement. I'll stop there. Peter?
I think it's not as easy as some of you think for preparers to make those materiality judgments. And I think that depends on, particularly on the regulatory and enforcement regime. So what I hear a lot from people who are subject to Sarbanes-Oxley is that if we've got a long list of disclosures in the standard, then they'll have to document their judgments and how they reach those conclusions for everything that's in the list, even if they decide that they're not going to get there. And so there is some difficulty also for the factors that Glenn mentioned. It can actually be quite a costly process to go through and quite difficult for them as well.
Carla?
Yeah, just a short comment. I think it's from a practical point of view, there is no such thing as zero-based disclosure. So if you did something last year, the auditors were happy, regulators were happy, you will do that again. And it's very difficult to take something away. So it kind of, in a geological way, things will pile up. And over time, you have more and more useless disclosure, which actually, more than materiality, in some cases, change is fundamental. I mean, reporting that you are doing, say, depreciation based on GAAP will appear, at least in my country, everywhere. And it's totally useless. Because you're not saying this is the useful life of things. You're simply saying that I'm doing as I'm supposed to do. And so taking things from your financial statements, it's challenging, because I did it last year, regulator was happy, auditors were happy. Why am I taking that away, except for the cost of making this publish? So the point is, goes beyond materiality, this idea that, look, take into account changes. Don't repeat things that have been published without a change in your financial statements for the last 20 years. Because that's what actually happened. People are saying this, look, what we're hearing here is a cry for help. That, look, I'm doing this because I'm assuming that you asked me to do that. And so if and I want to do it in that way, in a different way, then tell me that I can do it a different way. How to do that? Well beyond saying that, look, go back to the rule and look at what's material. Because it is material, but it's useless. Because it was material, I'd say, at a certain point. But you're just repeating things that, well, one could say, they're material, but you're not doing anything different from the rules. That's probably the challenge we have.
Thanks. So we've got two more sections to cover. So what we'll do is we'll go Carlos, Jeff, Marietta. And then we'll hand back to Catherine for the other two sections.
It's just quickly going through an example. I think when you look at notes on the pension, you may have maybe more detailed notes when you have a complicated pension situation, but the notes are more or less the same. And it's very, very hard for us, at least, to go through those notes and to get to the most important numbers. And I'm sure if the CFO of the company looks at that, he can probably improve a lot how he would disclose that kind of situation, depending on how the patient, how serious the patient problem or the patient numbers are. So for me, it's a clear case where you could probably increase a lot the quality of the information if there is some judgment around what's material, what's not, and so it's almost like if it's not important, fine, you just give this information. But if it is material and important enough, maybe you can show the numbers in such a way that discloses better your own situation.
Jeff,
it's not a view, or I'm not sure what it is actually. I'll tell you in a second. materiality and relevance. If the note's not read, makes materiality and relevance irrelevant. What I would like to see is whether you could actually do kind of heat map studies on sets of accounts. And actually, I know you can do this, is that you can run on an HTML document, you can run a heat map, and there's a high correlation between the movement of the mouse and the eyeball, and actually see which parts of the accounts actually get read over a wide population. And I think that would just be interesting information to throw into the mix. Because that happens to you every time you open up an email. You know, for us, and my way of reading our stuff.
Marietta.
So I'm very sympathetic in theory to the idea that the preparer should use judgment on materiality seen through the eyes of the investors. Just from my experience interacting with preparers, it is very, very difficult for them to put themselves into the shoes of investor because they've just never done the investment job, and it's very, very different from anything else you can do. So it's very, very difficult for them, as you said, to actually judge what could be relevant to investors. It's a little bit like asking a patient to tell the doctor everything that could be relevant to the doctor. You know, it's just the patient just doesn't know. So I think that is part of the reason we get so much boilerplating, in addition to the whole legal environment, which is obviously nothing to do with IFRS. But the other issue is, and this has been raised before as well, it's always really bad if something is missing because you never know when it could actually become material. And at the same time, I do feel that whenever the preparers don't feel the pressure to disclose something to protect themselves from a legal perspective, a lot of times they would prefer not to disclose it because they don't want to wake any sleeping dogs, they don't want to make anyone nervous that they are getting nervous about a certain situation. So I think in that regard, it's not a bad idea to actually have a laundry list where we say, okay, this is stuff that we always want to know no matter what, or if you really don't want to disclose it, you know, explain to us why you're not disclosing it. Just to give a very, very simple example, I mean, for the healthcare sector, Venezuela was completely immaterial for as long as the currency was more or less hanging in there. But once it became totally worthless, and these firms realized they still can't walk away from their patients and let them die, it had a very material negative effect in the P&L. So, you know, I'd always want to know as much as possible about the geographic split of the business so that, you know, if there is suddenly a big issue in one country or a big issue with one counterparty or something like that, I can go back to the accounts and see, what the exposure was. So that's where, I think we can just really help the preparers, A, understand what we want, and B, sort of get them out of that moral hazard situation.
Thanks, Marietta. So, Catherine, before we move on to the other two sections, did you want to come back or...?
I think it might be worth me just briefly summarising what I'm hearing, because like I said, we are discussing these things within the next few weeks, so it's good to make sure that what I'm hearing is something you'd all agree with, and then I do have potentially one little question. So I think the discussion almost very well reflects the challenge that the board are going to face in making next step decisions, because I think there's definitely a view in the room that, you know, IFRS standards already contain what theoretically preparers should need to apply judgment and apply materiality and make their disclosures more effective. However, we have heard some sympathy for the position that preparers are in, and I think much like we've heard from the rest of the feedback, a feeling that for investors the bigger concern is what's missing. So coming out of that, I think the question that I'd have for the room, coming back to the point about the board potentially making a gesture in terms of moving the improvements in disclosure forward, whether anyone, and I'm perhaps looking at Marietta and Glenn specifically as it came from their comments, had a view on if the board could do something that would actively help preparers to understand why disclosure requirements are there from, you know, an investor perspective. Would you see that as a beneficial activity for them to do? Because I think what we're trying to isolate is what could the board actually do that would be helpful, and that from the discussion I've heard is perhaps something that they might consider.
It's not, I mean, just sorry to speak out of turn, it would be helpful if you would also, in the process of doing that, eliminate some things. Because if you just ended up with a whole set of justification for why you were right, I mean, that would sound like you weren't listening.
maybe an idiot. Maybe these standards could somehow, because exactly what Paolo said, this is very common, and because it was in last year, it's in this year. So somehow,
the next year,
and somehow that the preparer should every year reconsider the inclusion of a particular disclosure. That's like you could put in that as a requirement. That's a principle-based requirement. And that actually, if the regulator or the auditor steps in and says, "Oh, hold on, why did you no longer include it? Well, we had to review it. That's part of it." And that's a principle-based. Because actually, I would expect a company to do so. And by including it in the standard, you make it a requirement to review.
Sort of a priori what they're doing every time they... Is it just to reinforce what's already established? Is that redundant, I guess?
Maybe it is redundant, but it is at least a signal. You're asking for a principle signal that basically I would expect it anyway that they would do so, but right. If the ISV reiterates it's a requirement to review, it's just an idea. I mean, maybe it's... generates other ideas in the right direction.
It's quite an appealing idea, I have to say. I wonder whether you have a on top of that, maybe going against what you said, but an additional disclosure requirement to say, here's what we're no longer disclosing. I don't know.
And it's, I mean, I think there's always an element of, oh, you know, we're doing what we've always done, so there can't be anything wrong with it. So, you know, if you basically, I think it's very important in any respect to constantly get management to challenge what they've always been doing.
If I could, in five words, cut the boilerplate unless you have a new boilerplate.
Okay, Catherine, should we move on to parts two and three?
Yes. So the next topic is the one headed project focus and prioritisation. This one I expect to be quite a bit briefer. Essentially, the point that we wanted to ask you about here is the fact that apart from the central things the board could do to help address the disclosure problem, the discussion paper also raised a number of other quite specific things the board could do to help with particular aspects of disclosure. And one of the decisions that we will be looking at in March is how to prioritise those things and isolate the ones that would be of most benefit. So on slide 10, we have summarised five of the possible activities that the board might do in terms of developing guidance or requirements that were discussed in the DP, and have listed them in the order of priority that one could read from taking all of the letters we've had and balancing all the different views. So briefly on that list, there was quite a bit of support for guidance around which accounting policies to disclose, because that is an area that people struggle with today. The concept of location, IFRS information outside the financial statements, non-IFRS information inside was also generally supported. And then we think perhaps of lower priority might be the board developing guidance around formatting of financial statements or the location of accounting policy disclosures. And the question we had for you really was whether you had any views on the relative importance of those topics, and if there's any of them you particularly highlight as something you'd really want the board to get involved in.
Catherine, do you want to cover the third topic as well, and then we'll kind of do around?
I can do, yeah. Yep, so the third topic is a specific question on the effect of technology. So again, this was something that we didn't ask a particular question about in the discussion paper, but a lot of respondents came back and said the board ought to think about it. And essentially the point that those respondents were making was that as technology develops, the way that companies communicate with their users is changing, is becoming more digital reporting based. So some of the topics that the board might think about addressing, such as location and formatting of financial statements, might perhaps become less relevant, and something the board should consider if there are any new issues introduced in terms of disclosure by those new electronic communications. So the question that we had was whether considering the potential issues introduced by digital technology is something that you would want the board to be looking at within this context, or whether considering the disclosure in financial statements format that they are today, i.e. a physical book, you think will remain worthwhile in its own right as a separate exercise from technology.
Okay, so just remind people the questions are on slide 11 and slide 14 of the pack. So I think Paolo, do you want to kick off?
Yeah, it's just going back to what I just said. based on this slide 10. Sometimes I have the feeling that there is a confusion between a principle and a policy. And if you can do A or B, you should tell investors, what are you doing, A or B? There is just one option. You simply have to do B or A, whatever. It doesn't make sense to repeat that you're doing A. And if you could, I mean, quote-unquote, declutter it, if this distinction was really clear for preparers, don't disclose that you're doing the sole thing that you are supposed to do. In many cases, you see that. Tell us what option you are following, if you have an option.
James? Yes, on the digital question, I think it is very important to retain a single PDF document. I am totally against the fragmentation on websites that say, oh, we've got, you know, it's all web-based, our disclosure, you go to page this, whatever, you go, you click this and you get that, because, I mean, I've, in just the last decade, I've sort of had to work through 5 bank failures, I did find that on 3 of them, crucial information from those websites had gone away. Yeah. Come your assessment of when a bank goes into terminal decline, so I had luckily stored. Luckily, I weren't invested in any of those. But questions are always asked whether you should go in at the last as a vulture, I think it's quite important to insist on a single document still being the main repository of everything that is disclosed annually, quarterly, or if you do quarterly or half yearly as well. So that's my point on the digital. Thank you.
Thank you. Martin?
Yeah, I read from a general technology perspective, we're heading to a future where inline XBRL is hopefully going to add to the accessibility of information for investors in Europe, because ESMA will require a central database, central filing of those documents, and actually that will, and it already does, affect how much information, how much data investor can process. So in line with your comments, fragmentation is going to make things worse, because it's less difficult, it's more difficult to gather the information altogether. I think this particular topic, the second IFRS information outside the financial statement, probably relates to cross-referencing, and not so much whether information is being put outside the annual report altogether. And I think this is already happening, and it needs to be addressed. So I would put a high priority on there. And on which accounting policies to discuss, probably the most visible reason why this project started in the first place, because the accounting policies are so meaningless and eat up so much space in the report. So I would put that a high priority. And on information inside the financial statements, well, that deserves a principle-based approach as well. I mean, like ESMA, the ESMA guidelines can be transported. I would put a high priority on that one. I mean, these are all very, very, very relevant elements. Location of accounting policies. Yeah, you might as well solve that one as well if you're working on the first one. I mean, how can you not do that? I mean, and formatting. Well, there. I struggle a bit. I mean, maybe more principle-based guidance how to format stuff than totally losing prescribing formats for all kinds of stuff. I think that what's already was in the discussion paper, was it a discussion paper, was helpful in the direction to highlight what is useful, how that if you're going to try to describe a table in words, that's not helpful. I mean, this is not low or higher, this is all relevant stuff.
Thanks, Matai. Mitch?
On the technology questions, disaggregation is a disaster. So having said that, I agree on the 1P, but physical book, I don't know anyone who still uses the physical book. They're pretty, but I honestly don't know anyone who uses them. And then the other thing on the technology side, I think what's important is as much as possible, the data, the information, the numbers should still be easily extractable into, say, for example, data aggregators, third-party vendors like Bloomberg or whatever. So that with all these changes that we've talked about, for example, the management performance measures, these kinds of things, all of that should be in the kind of format that data aggregators can hoover up and they can be downloaded again by analysts.
It's me. So, I very strongly agree with what you said, James, about the kind of perimeter of financial reporting and having that single document that you can download or whatever. So it's very clear what that represents, and that's a complete set of information. Within that, there may be cross-references, but that's kind of what you have and you can save and stuff. And that would, let's say it's a PDF, but there are PDFs and there are PDFs, right? There are PDFs which for some reason I could never get to open as a single page, side-by-side pages, which is not helpful, gives you kind of scrolling. And there's some PDFs actually really, really helpful because they have hyperlinks within them. So you say where it says, we disclose more detail on this on page 57, and there's a click, and you go back. And on page 57, there's a click to go back. So I think there's something to be said for formatting in that sense. I think is I don't know whether it's for the ISB or not, but I think I haven't seen this year's report yet, but in past years, Lloyds Banking Group, for example, has done a very reasonable effort at its PDF in terms of kind of being able to navigate it.
If I may, there is one risk in doing that, as I'm told by U.S. lawyers, that the moment you do that, you are incorporating in your disclosure every link.
But it's within the same PDF. It's not going to a website elsewhere.
Okay, but if you include a link, then that becomes part of your disclosure material.
The link is from page 1 to page...
Okay, I see, internal link.
Internal links.
Okay, sorry.
But I think what's interesting is when you talk about formatting in the appendix on page 18, you explain what that means and you touch on more frequent use of tables and graphs. So this is not what I understand as formatting, but I think if that's what you're talking about formatting, then yes, encouraging greater tabular disclosure for quantitative information rather than having it in narrative I think is helpful. Keeping formats consistent period to period is helpful. I think that's something to be prioritized. And then in terms of which accounting policies to disclose, again, I think you touched on this a little bit more on slide 16, talking about how those policies can be long and unhelpful due to lack of clarity. I think that is right. I think the answer is not to necessarily take them away or put them on a website. I think the answer is to make them specific to that company. Even, I think, Paolo, you talked about where there's no accounting policy choice, then why have it? Sometimes I think that can be true, but I think sometimes there isn't an accounting policy choice, but there's certain nuances for how that company applies that accounting policy that are important to understand. And just having the copy and paste from the standard itself may not be quite what's needed. So this always worries me when I see this in this disclosure discussion, because I think the aim of preparers seems to be to take it away, and I don't think it's not that useful at the moment, but the answer is not to take it away. The answer, I think, is to make it potentially more useful and more relevant. I'll stop there and hand over to Jeff.
Just on the technology side,
I'm infuriated when companies secure their PDFs.
Yeah.
I can break them, but I'm not allowed to do that at work. Because it just makes the scraping of that data to get into a spreadsheet kind of awkward. Quite like the, I don't know whether we can enforce this, but I can find this year's PDF, and then it's an absolute nightmare trying to find prior year PDFs in some companies, so I don't know whether that can be enforced. Things like, you know, being able to tag, it almost gets back to your hyperlinks, but taking that a step further, of having kind of keywords tagged within a PDF becomes quite useful. You've got this idea of kind of natural language processing where you can get computers to read financial statements and infer, I suppose, nuances and sentences. I mean, this is where I think sell-side research ultimately is kind of going, is down this whole kind of tech route. And you don't see it so much in Europe, but in emerging markets, PDFs where the accounts are scanned in are not so useful. Especially when they're not straight.
The largest bank in Europe in Spain does that.
Yeah. But I don't know to what extent you can have any control over that, but that is stuff from a usability perspective makes a huge difference.
Okay. Marietta?
Yeah, I just wanted to stress once again the importance of having tables and ideally have them available in Excel format and really having a table where sort of you've got all of the numbers in one place and they add up to the big number, because we're actually seeing a very, very dangerous trend lately where a lot of hard financial information that you're really looking for as an analyst is actually scattered all over the report, buried in some narrative amongst a lot of fluff. And it's basically completely impossible for any associate to find them. You really need the senior analyst who has been following that specific company to even have a chance to really find it properly. And even when you find it, it can be a little bit difficult to interpret because you're never quite sure which line in the table it actually refers to. So in my sector, there are companies with big contingent liabilities. You get the short-term and the long-term contingent liabilities in the balance sheet. And that's all you get. And then you go through the financial statement looking for the components of those contingent liabilities. And when you get the components, you're not quite sure which ones of them are actually for the short-term and for the long-term section of the balance sheet. So just making that table myself where I have, you know, long-term contingent liability one, long-term contingent liability two, adding up to the full contingent liability, it just takes forever. And, you know, there's no sort of like, you know, value added from doing that over having the preparers do it in the first place.
Thanks, Marietta. Goro, sorry.
Okay. Technology or the future of corporate reporting type agenda is a kind of a very favorite agenda at the advisory council meeting. Almost every time I discuss about this. But the, yeah, I found, you know, most of us here is, you know, rather the older generation, and we are more familiar with the paper-based or PDF-based. But still, that the, you know, the technology is progressing so rapid, and I think we should be mindful that the what kind of impact would be appeared on that the corporate reporting field. Clearly, that the, you know, that the boundary of the financials and the non-financials are becoming more blur. For example, that the MPM, it used to be regarded as out of financials, but now we are talking about that the moving it into the financials. So that this obscuring of a boundary of financial and non-financials are occurring at the same time, concurrently with the progress in technology, so that we should be very mindful of the kind of interaction of these two trends.
Bertrand, final
yes,
word.
Just one very short comment with regard to the PDF. You may be in a situation where you have no connection with internet, even with your smartphone. In that case, having a PDF is very useful because you may have the need to work on this file, on a specific file, and be able to look at the financial statement and the annual report as a whole is very, very useful.
Catherine, do you want to ask any final questions or sum up? Or?
I will sum up briefly. I think the question on slide 10, where we had the prioritisation list, the message I am getting from all the comments that have been made is that these are all things that the ISB could usefully do something about. Probably the one that's had the least comment from the room is the bottom one on location of accounting policies, but all of the others I feel like have a bit of appetite for the ISB potentially to do something there. And then on technology, a lot of the comments have been about the potential challenges around PDFs, I will say this to make sure I'm not taking the wrong message from the room, I would read that to mean PDFs of financial statements as they are today at the moment, because I think, you know, whilst this is a big thing that the ISB will be thinking about, there's almost questions around disclosure in financial statements as they are today, whether that be, you know, physical or in PDF, but a set of financial statements in the format you get them today, and then there is almost digital extraction of information such, and there are sort of two issues there. So I think we've had quite a number of comments on the PDF side, which we will take forward in thinking about whether to include those considerations in
I just had a couple of comments briefly. Just first of all, this was a very wide ranging discussion paper, and through the feedback actually more topics were added in terms of technology, in terms of we must have a standards level review. So I think a key decision for the board now is actually trying to narrow down. We do need to prioritise going forward, otherwise we're going to struggle to achieve anything. So at least to know where we're going to go first will be a key issue that the board will think about, I guess, later this month. We also need to manage expectations, and that's for preparers as well as for users. And one of my fellow board members is very clear, saying to preparers, be careful what you ask for. You want a standards level review, you may get more requests for disclosures rather than less, so we come to this with an open mind. And then on technology, I think we do hear very clearly the importance of having a single reference document, by which we've talked about the PDF as a shorthand for that. But the foundation will be investing more resource in thinking about technology more broadly, longer term, how this will impact financial reporting, and that will be developing over the months ahead, I would say.
Great. So now we come to my favourite part of the day, which is lunch.